All right, very important couple of months, obviously, ahead. We got some primaries to focus in on, June 28th, August 23rd. Also, a judge with a very important ruling yesterday regarding redistricting. We'll get into that with our good pal, Mr. Jeff Gio, Millennial Strategies, political guru. And I haven't spoken to Jeff in a while. It's good to have him back, though. How are you? How you been? How's the family?
Jay, it has been entirely too long. Good to be with you, my friend. The family is great. Just send them off to school.
That's always a good thing, right? Sending kids to school. Isn't that a great thing these days?
Yeah, unless you're Greg Abbott down in Texas, it's pretty great.
Got to throw that in. All right, listen. Let's get into some stuff. Let's kind of see what happened yesterday with a state Supreme Court judge, Pat McAllister, refused to throw out the new maps for the state assembly district. He said some of the litigants, I guess, had waited a little too long to join the lawsuit, resulted in the redrawing of state Senate congressional maps. So, you know, we know what happened in January as far as the Democratic-led state ledge approving the new election maps. And it's interesting, Jeff, how the judge kind of noted the lawsuit alleging gerrymandering of Senate congressional lines were filed in February. Didn't include the assembly there. So, you know, you get these caveats from these judges, you know, so many different ways to look at this whole thing, including with what happened with Judge McAllister yesterday.
Sure. I mean, so there's two, like, kind of separate points that I think are interesting to note about redistricting, which is kind of an eye-glazing topic for, like, the average political follower. I think one of the reasons why the assembly maps ended up holding up in the Senate and congressional ones didn't is pretty simple. The assembly maps, were drawn by a very similar group of folks 10 years ago, really didn't deviate all that much from the previous maps. Right, like if you look at Long Island's districts, most of them stayed largely the same, and you know, the same can be said for upstate city. Whereas, perhaps the Democrats were a little too trigger happy in drawing some pretty wild Senate and congressional districts in efforts to protect the Democratic majority, both in the House of Representatives and in the state Senate. And it's really important to understand that, you know, what is going to happen in New York and what has happened in New York really, one, bucks a national trend, and two, it has real and tangible, you know, national implications. You had a situation where you had, Republican gerrymanders in Ohio and in Florida, and a Democratic gerrymander in New York, which are all, you know, similarly sized states with, you know, 20-something congressional seats. And, you know, Republican judges, by and large, I know the Florida map changed a little bit yesterday, but by and large, Republican judges in those Republican states upheld Republican gerrymanders. Here in New York, Cuomo appointed Democratic judges throughout our maps. And it's going to put House Democrats and Senate Democrats at a larger disadvantage than they already had going into November. So this has both hyper-local implications and national implications. And don't even get me started on the fact that now we have two different primaries this summer.
June 28th and August 23rd, we'll get into that in a second. But basically, folks, what McAllister is saying, the state is facing, you know, a very tight schedule for conducting these primaries. And that's why, you know, he stated, Jeff, that the assembly maps adopted early in the year, it's going to stand as is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is going to be absolutely chaotic come later on this month, because what you have is a situation where assembly primaries, which are mostly New York City-centric, to be fair, and the gubernatorial primary, which is obviously a big statewide contest between the incumbent governor, Congressman Tom Suozzi, public advocate Jumaane Williams, that's going to be heating up come the middle of May, where folks will be making their persuasion pitch to voters. At the same time, petitioning is going to reopen for these congressional and state Senate seats, meaning that folks who look at the new lines and decide to run but didn't try to qualify for the ballot previously under the old lines can jump into these races And you're going to have a situation where you're going to have petitioning for the August primary taking place at the same time while folks are knocking doors, reminding folks to come out and vote on June 28th. If you think that is not confusing to a low information voter, you got another thing coming. It is going to lead to a huge amount of disinformation and chaos, which is what nobody needs. But yet that's where we find ourselves.
No doubt. So again, the state of New York will have split primaries. The contest for the statewide offices, you know, the gubernatorial, the assembly, that will be on June 28th. The senatorial and the congressional, you are looking at August the 23rd. Folks, you need a scorecard. And this is what I've said all along. And I'm not even trying to be funny.
It's one of the reasons why you have to pay attention to Jay Oliver all summer long, boys and girls.
Well, the whole thing is...
Someone needs to track this for you.
It really is. It's unbelievable. And you have this neutral special master, as it's being called, appointed by Judge McAllister. They're set to propose new maps for Congress and Senate districts. That's happening, I do believe, on Monday, you see.
Yeah, it's going to happen on Monday, and then the final maps have the force of law on Friday the 20th, and then the next day petitions go out.
And, you know, and with that, you know, there's going to be some you know, the whole thing was, in trying to figure this out, are we going to find new names now added to all this after Monday, new candidates? One. Two, are people going to have to have petitions all over again with signature, in your estimation, after all is said on Monday?
So my understanding of what the judge's ruling was yesterday, which came down about like 2:33 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday, was that if you have already qualified for the ballot in the congressional district that or Senate district that you're seeking to run in, you're on the ballot. You don't have to petition again. But if you take a look at the new maps and you're like, oh wow, like this looks cool, let me jump in, then you have to petition your way back on within a 20-day period starting on May 21st. And if you look at it from, you know, a hyper local Long Island centric lens, you know, you're going to probably have a situation where the Zeldin seat gerrymander, which ran Lee Zeldin's district from Montauk into Bethpage, will probably become a little more competitive for a Republican. And you'll probably have a situation where the Andrew Garbarino seat is probably going to become a little more competitive for a Democrat. Like, those seats will be moderated, would be my guess, if you're going to return to some sense of normalcy with these. And so as a result, like, you could very well see, you know, perhaps a more accomplished Republican run in New York 1, and perhaps a more accomplished Democrat run in New York 2. And then the really fascinating thing about this, Jay, is there's a situation where if you are a Tom Suozzi, and you want to double down on having a job in politics come the end of the year, my understanding of the law is that Tom, or anyone else for that matter, who's vacating a seat in Congress to run for another office, could very well petition his way on to his old congressional seat and run for Congress in the event that he loses the gubernatorial primary. Like, all these crazy scenarios have now been opened up, and it's going to be fascinating.
Well, here's Jeff Gill with us. You brought up the Suozzi name, and let's get into that with the governor. Kathy Hochul has agreed to two debates, June 7th and 16th, I do believe. Those are going to be two very important dates for Tom Suozzi. As you mentioned, maybe he could vie for his old seat. We'll see what happens. But those are going to be two that he'll analyze thereafter as he gets ready for that big day, 12 days after the second debate. A very important a couple for Tom, because he's got to make up some ground. Listen, he's got the arsenal, okay? He's running a pretty good TV commercial. The latest polls, you know, listen, Hochul is still the incumbent, and we know how incumbents are treated in this state. But when you look at Tom Suozzi, it's a last-ditch effort in so many ways to make up ground. And he's got the grounds to do it based on news events over the last couple of months.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the honeymoon is definitely over with Kathy Hochul. I think that much has become true. Like, there are certainly vulnerabilities in both the primary and the general election that have become clear, just based upon the way the legislature has kind of treated some of her priorities. Point one, and also, you know, the fact that Hochul agreed to these two debates on the 7th and the 16th really says a lot. About how she's worried about being exposed in a debate, not just with Suozzi, who's essentially running to her right, but Williams, who's running to her left. The important thing to note, notably about June 16th, is that people will be voting already. The early voting window is already open at that time. This is New York. You're still going to see a decent amount of folks voting by mail and stuff like that because of COVID concerns. So, like, people will have already been casting ballots when this debate is happening. So it's kind of notable that was the date that was inherently selected here. I know that both Suozzi and Williams wanted her to agree to a schedule of 7 debates, which she was never going to do, and I don't think anyone ever advised her to do that. But the fact that we're not doing this, you know, maybe June 1 or at the end of May is kind of telling about, you know, where this perception is. And like, it is not uncommon for incumbents to not want to do more debates, and it's always the role of the challenger or the one who is losing in the polls to want to do more debates. But doing one on the 16th when folks are already voting is kind of odd.
If I'm in charge of the Hochul campaign, I don't know if I would have agreed to 2, Jeff. I think 1. I don't know 2, because
yeah.
I'm basically not in a position where I need to do 2 debates. You know, you can make the case 2 debates could actually hurt Kathy Hochul when you analyze it.
I mean, did Andrew Cuomo debate Zephyr Teachout twice? I don't think so. Did Andrew Cuomo debate Cynthia Nixon twice? I don't think so. I seem to recall the only debate that Andrew Cuomo did in the general election against Rob Astorino a few years back was when he debated with all the candidates on stage. If you remember that whole production with Jimmy McMillan and Howie Hawkins, all these third-party candidates on stage together, you know, like, those were all the debates that her predecessor wanted to do. So there's definitely, you know, a precedent to limit the scope of the debate schedule, like you said.
Give Tom Suozzi a big-time chance to upend this incumbent come June 20th?
I think it would take something beyond Tom's control for that to take place. I mean, you know, I think Tom has certainly raised enough money to be competitive in this race. I mean, he's been pointing to a poll that shows him gaining momentum. There was a New York Post story about it a couple days ago. But it would certainly take another Brian Benjamin type scandal, another, you know, huge inflection point in this primary, I think, to create that lane. And that's not outside of the realm of possibility for sure. But I think if this played out the way it is, and you saw, you know, Hochul reach into that rather sizable war chest she's amassed, you know, like, she should be able to at least ride name recognition to winning the primary.
Jeff Giel with us on Millennial Strategies, breaking down what will be a very, very interesting summer. Ladies and gentlemen, here in New York, the primaries upon us, June 28th, August 23rd, streamlining to the GE, of course, November the 8th. Let's go to the other side. Lee Zeldin, his name out there more prominent than any of the others. Do we see a debate on the GOP side of things coming up?
I don't. I think that the institutional sources and your institutional turnout machines, which are still very strong on the Republican side, should be able to put Zeldin over here. You know, I don't think there's an appetite for someone who's running because his dad is Rudy Giuliani, and I think that Harry Wilson is a little late in the game in trying to build his own name recognition here. And we've all kind of known Rob Astorino was a joke the entire time. So I think Zeldin will probably win the primary with enough of a mandate to give him a decent amount of momentum going into the general election.
I has Andrew Giuliani runs such a horrendous campaign. I mean, let's face it, if you're banking on the last name, that's okay. But really, you brought nothing to the table outside of a flower pot hitting him in the head. So in essence, is that the blame for his lack of thinking getting into this thing and going forward?
You know, I always viewed the Giuliani thing as kind of a stunt to get him his next job. And people run for office for that reason all the time. And this is probably another one of those things. And also, like, really bad politics and really lousy political decision-making and running really lousy campaigns, you know, kind of running the Giuliani family. Do you remember that all-in on Florida strategy for Rudy for president back in the day? You know, it just seems like a distinctive familial trait that is only exacerbated by this, like, quixotic exercise we're seeing out of Mr. Giuliani.
Vying anything regarding Tom Suozzi getting back to that third, George Santos makes another run. Now, listen, Santos, if you remember, during the last congressional election, he was leading. After election night, of course, you had all the absentees and everything else come in. Tom Suozzi with a landslide, basically. But what about the congressional third if Tom does not re-enter the ring there? Okay.
Well, the big thing with New York 3 is not George Santos, right now, at least, right? I mean, he's got his own baggage and his own scandal to deal with, which he should probably, you know, try his best to litigate while all the Democrats are out there knifing each other to death. If the district stands as is, I mean, it's I think it was, what, like a Biden plus 13 district or something like that. So it's not likely a Republican would win. The real question with the third is, you know, do the map makers look at this ridiculous district and realize that there's no reason why there should ever be a district where that runs from Smithtown to Pelham in Westchester County, you know, taking a bite out of the Bronx as well. And the person who's most impacted by this, because I think the third will always be a largely Long Island seat. So the Robert Zimmermans and Josh Lapizans and John Kamens of the world, you know, will probably get a district they like more. But Senator Alessandra Biaggi of Westchester, who used a great deal of her own family political capital to get this district drawn in the first place, could find herself without a chair and without a district to run for Congress in after the special master finishes their job. Because if the reason why you draw congressional districts is to find, you know, similar places with, you know, that are socioeconomically and sociodemographically similar, there's no earthly reason why people in Smithtown would have the same wants and needs as people in the Bronx or people in Mamaroneck in Westchester County. So that's the really interesting actor to follow, I think, in New York 3, outside of what the incumbent member of Congress does.
Barbarino, is he in some trouble depending on what happens after Monday? Where do you see the second?
Yeah, I mean, the second was drawn to be one of New York's two safe Republican districts under the old maps. So they were going to concede a Republican district that ran from Southampton to Massapequa along the affluent parts of the South Shore, and then also keep Elise Stefanik's district up in the North Country. And that was it. That was the original plan, that New York was going to have two safe Republican seats, and Garbarino occupied one of them. He then subsequently has drawn interest from primary challengers on the right. But this is another district that, like, one would think, if you took an objective look at it, it would probably, you know, manifest itself more into what Peter King's district historically looked like, where you've got the towns of Babylon and Islip, and then, you know, a requisite piece of Nassau County. And, you know, that is a district that in recent years, you know, Lubo Gretchen Shirley being the most recent Democratic challenger, who's done fairly well out there. So, you know, Garbarino could end up having to deal with a primary from his right, and then perhaps a spirited Democratic challenger. Although, again, look at the calendar. I mean, it's going to take a long time to build a war chest necessary to be competitive in a brand new seat where there's been no Democratic activity. But of course, what could also always happen is you can see someone running in currently in New York 1 or New York 4 decide to drop into a theoretically more moderated New York 2, which could certainly change things for Garbarino. But the important thing to understand, though, is that you know, when you look at some of these gerrymandered districts, and you look at what Republican turnout versus Democratic turnout looked like in November, and if you look at one of these districts and you see that Biden won that district by 6 points, 7 points, 8 points, unless the Democratic messaging on a national level changes dramatically, unless the Democrats have a reason to turn out their base, Biden plus seven looks pretty appetizing for a Republican, especially on Long Island and in Westchester and upstate New York right now. And I think a lot of the new seats on both the congressional and the Senate side will probably find themselves in that bucket. And so you're going to have a lot of money spent from a lot of places and a lot of competitive races.
No question. And, you know, you go into CD1, and that's another one where, you know, the gap might have been closed based on everything that we're talking about here. And then you got a guy like Nick LaLota thrown into this thing. And that sets up a very interesting situation in itself.
Right. Nick LaLota, last I checked, lives in Amityville. You know, so it's already a stretch to have him running in a district that goes out to Montauk Point. And now, if the district ends up being drawn again, he could very well find himself thrown in there with Garbarino and the other Republicans in that race. Plus, maybe Jackie Gordon drops back down into New York too, based upon where she lives and what the landscape is going to be. So, you'll definitely see some musical chairs here as far as candidates, especially as it pertains to the first and second districts, because, I mean, if you apply logic to the situation, there's no earthly reason really why there should be a district that runs from, like, Orient Point all the way into, like, you know, Bethpage State Park.
Is Laura Gillen a serious candidate as far as the congressional fourth that Kathleen Rice has said farewell?
Oh, yeah. I think that seat is Laura Gillen's to lose right now. I mean, you know, she's got a lot of prominent endorsements here. Certainly has the name recognition. She's got the endorsement of the outgoing member of Congress, of Kathleen Rice. The fourth is interesting because that's a seat, you know, that is essentially Nassau County south of the Long Island Expressway,
yeah.
For the most part. And it really didn't change very much in redistricting. It remains a strong Democratic seat. It remains a really strong blue-collar district. And, you know, I haven't seen any fundraising numbers or any polling data or anything that indicates that any of these other candidates are going to be able to make headway in the Democratic primary.
And that, you know, leads me into the senatorial here on the island, where it is, I mean, you talk about confusion, folks. You look at Phil Boyle hanging him up after 26 years. You got Alexis Wyke moving over third to the fourth.
For now.
Here we go again with Monica Martinez throwing a little Dean Murray. I mean, come on. I mean, you got a WWE royal match going here, my friend, in a couple of these districts.
I believe the term of art, Jay, is Royal Rumble. But yes, yeah, you're exactly right. And again, like, the chairs keep moving on this thing. It's premature to almost speculate as to what that's all going to look like come next Friday. You know, like, the Democrats' plan for the last 2 years has been to, you know, draw a district that encompasses the majority of Hispanic communities in Suffolk County. And I do think, by the way, that both Nassau and Suffolk should have, like, by the numbers, not just me being a partisan Democrat here, should have a majority minority district, given the ever-growing minority population of the counties. But irrespective of that, the plan all along was to draw a seat that was favorable for Monica to stage her comeback. And the special master may not agree with my assertion that there should be a majority-minority district in Suffolk County. I don't know. And so that could make this whole situation a little less appealing for former Senator Martinez. And furthermore, it could certainly change where a Dean Murray or where a Senator Wilk or so on and so forth decides to run. You know, it really, really changes the dynamics here. So, you know, and then, given some of the, like, you know, the kind of wild gerrymander you saw over in Nassau County, where Democrats took a lot of the conservative Orthodox Jewish population of the five towns and put them in a district with Senator James Sanders from Queens to be able to make Todd Kominsky, soon to be former Senator Todd Kominsky's district, more appetizing. for a Democrat to win. That could all change. So, you know, I would love to come on once the new maps are out and talk about, like, what the landscape for the state Senate looks like. Because right now, I mean, statewide, we really don't know. And it's not just a Long Island problem. I mean, you know, the Democrats created two new seats in New York City. One that was supposed to be engineered to elect a Hispanic candidate in Queens, one that was engineered to elect an Asian candidate in Brooklyn. That could all change. There was a fierce gerrymander in upstate New York trying to protect certain Democratic members up there. So, you know, like no one knows what that landscape is going to be. And, like, you know, there's going to be some real... My phone is going to blow up pretty royally on Friday night when all this stuff comes out and candidates start making phone calls and scrambling for what their position is going to be at the end of all this.
We'll remain here with Jeff. All right, so, you know, you look at the senatorial, you look at the five here on the island, you look at Anna Kaplan, you look at the Kevin Thomases, the John Brooks, the Jimmy Gorins. You know, we know Kaminsky is gone for obvious reasons. But in essence... Based on all that has happened and everything else, I mean, how viable is it that most of those individuals will be ousted?
I think it is. It would be naive of anybody to think that there is not a real and tangible chance of turnover within the Long Island delegation. It's going to take a lot of money and a much stronger and more robust Democratic message coming straight from the top to be able to make this work. I mean, maybe it's the leaked Roe v. Wade memo, maybe it's something else, but like there needs to be a national message coupled with some really, really strong campaigns on the Democratic side, some really, really well-funded campaigns on the Democratic side to prevent the bloodbath that we saw last year island-wide.
And do you sense that bloodbath is coming November the 8th based on events that have occurred here?
If nothing changes, if they held the election tomorrow, that bloodbath would occur.
All right. Last one for you, Mr. Gio. Who is sitting in the mansion in the state capitol come January of 2022?
Now, Jay, you know this about me. I'm a gambling man. And I think that if you were to apply objective odds to it, and apply all the math and data that is available to us right now, the answer would be Kathy Hochul. There's a strong chance she wins the primary again based upon name recognition and war chest alone. And I've said this on your air before, and I'm going to stick to it. I think that I've long thought, going back to the age of George Pataki and Michael Bloomberg, that a moderate Republican who is decent on issues like the environment and choice and gun control can win statewide in New York. Lee Zeldin is not that guy. And when that is laid bare in a general election, I think that almost any Democrat who does not shoot themselves in the foot should be able to defeat him statewide. There's too many liberal votes in New York City.
That is the million-dollar question, and we shall see. Listen, it's always a pleasure to have you.
Always, Jay.
And we'll do it again. Not this much of a gap, though. How's that?
Yes, sounds good. Let's break down some new maps once they're out.
All righty. Always a lot of fun. Jeff Gio, Millennial Strategies, political guru. Stay well, family.
Thanks so much.